Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
The Supreme Court ruled this week that the Constitution upholds birthright citizenship for nearly all children born in the United States. As the New York Public News Network's Kimberly Izar reports, immigration advocates are breathing a sigh of relief.
Immigration advocates across New York State are celebrating a massive victory after the Supreme Court ruled to uphold birthright citizenship. Juana Cortez de Torres, Immigrant Legal Rights Director of Immigration Advocacy Nonprofit Rural and Migrant Ministry, says the decision brings a sense of stability for thousands of immigrants and migrant families.
This shines a light on a very important principle, and it is basic. If you are born here in the United States, you are a citizen of this country.
Advocates have been bracing for the Supreme Court's decision after President Trump passed an executive order last January seeking to end birthright citizenship. Cortez de Torres says Tuesday's ruling reaffirms the 14th Amendment and the Constitution, but that America's immigration system is still in limbo. The Supreme Court ruled last Thursday that the Trump administration can begin mass deportations of TPS holders from Haiti and Syria.
Immigration is clearly in flux, and we will have to continue to really analyze and look to see what remedies exist for the many hundreds of people who are here within our borders. That's a heavy lift. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Murad Awalda, president and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition, said in a press statement that, quote, "Even as we breathe a sigh of relief, Congress must act to create a pathway to citizenship for all immigrants and strengthen the humanitarian protections that reflect our values," end quote. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for the New York Public News Network.
Meanwhile, in a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court ruled to end legal protections for migrants fleeing violence and natural disaster in Haiti and Syria, exposing hundreds of thousands of more people to potential deportation. The decision blocks lower court orders and allows the Department of Homeland Security to swiftly end temporary protected status. The Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra discussed the decision and its possible impact with Renald Julian, the executive director of a community center and advocacy group for Haitian immigrants in a Rockland County village that is home to one of New York's largest Haitian communities.
Can you tell me, what are you feeling right now about this Supreme Court decision, and what are people in the community telling you right now?
Well, listen, I am not surprised. I am not surprised because I knew that day was coming, because I remember the first time that I spoke with you and to all the other, you know, members of the media, I told them what is going on in America has nothing to do with immigration. It is a black and white issue. When you look at the list of the different countries the racist Trump administration has targeted, they are all immigrants of color. Therefore, I am not surprised. The only problem is, why any of his people, why no one from the Republican Party didn't choose to make a difference? I can only speak about us Haitians. Let's say if we are not black, let's say Haiti was somewhere in Europe. Do you think he will ask over 300,000 Haitians to go back, you know, to a country in Europe, like, you know, that has a lot of crime? The answer is no. The answer is no. Again, this dude and all his friends from the Republican Party, they don't care. Okay? They don't care to make this kind of decisions, because the people they are asking to leave the country, the people they are asking to go back to a dangerous place like Haiti doesn't have the same skin color as them. So therefore, I am not surprised. I knew it was coming.
And in Spring Valley, which is one of the biggest Haitian communities in New York, what is the conversation that you are hearing? What are people telling you about how they're feeling about the news?
People are upset. Okay. I just had someone who was a surgeon in Haiti who was kidnapped more than two times to save his life and his family. They had to leave everything behind to come to the United States. Now, how in the world are you going to ask someone who was kidnapped two times to go back to the same country that only bring bad memory to him? They are not happy. But as their leader, all I have to say to them, better days are coming. That's all we have to say. We came here. We knew America wasn't our country. We came here. Most of us were invited through the Biden humanitarian program. We're invited.
You know, Congressman Mike Lawler has, sent out a press release today saying that he has worked to support, and he supports the Haitian community, although he is also a strong supporter of, the president. Do you have any feelings about where he stands and his support for the Haitian community?
All I have to say, if there was someone who could have done something to make it easier for the Haitians, it is Mike Lawler.
That's Renald Julian, executive director of Convit Neg Lakai, a community center, an advocacy group for Haitian immigrants in Rockland County, speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra. Congressman Mike Lawler, who represents Spring Valley in New York's 17th Congressional District, in a statement said he has consistently advocated for extending TPS for Haitian nationals. He said he co-led bipartisan legislation to extend TPS for Haiti and, quote, repeatedly urged the administration to maintain these protections, end quote. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A research lab in the Adirondacks was awarded $1 million in state funding. The Adirondack Watershed Institute conducts research and runs a summer stewardship program at boat launches across the park. Democratic Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie and Assemblyman Michael Cashman toured AWI last week before announcing the state funding. We get more from the New York Public News Network's Emily Russell.
The Adirondack Watershed Institute sits on the shores of Lower St. Regis Lake. It's part of Paul Smith's College. On a recent warm summer day, AWI's executive director Maureen Cunningham led a tour of the institute for assembly members Carl Hastie and Michael Cashman.
And we'll go downstairs to the lab.
AWI has been around for decades. They monitor about 200 lakes in the Adirondacks, which equates to about a third of the park's watershed. Hastie and Cashman filed into the first floor lab. AWI's Leah Trebergs gave the two a rundown of some of their research.
We are aiming to collect water quality data on lake and stream health, focusing on legacy and emerging threats like harmful algal blooms, acid deposition, road salt impacts, and climate change.
The Adirondacks are warming at a faster rate than the global average. Winters are getting shorter and milder, and summers are getting longer and hotter. One result of that is the algal blooms that Trebergs mentioned. They're popping up in places like Lake Champlain, and they can make the waters toxic for people, pets, and other animals. Hastie, who represents part of the Bronx, asked what could be done about it.
Is there a treatment for the lakes? What's the response when you find that the algae blooms are...
So there's not much in terms of immediate management that can be done.
The key, Treberg said, is to follow the state's advice. Know it, avoid it, report it. The DC has an online form that people can fill out to report harmful algal blooms.
Yeah. So now we're going to move into the working lab.
Hastie and Cashman gathered around a student lab tech wearing a white coat. Noah Rayberg used a syringe to pull a water sample from a plastic cup and then deposit it into little glass jars.
Yeah, so I'm filtering for DOC, which is dissolved organic carbon, and also anions and cations.
He's essentially preserving the water samples so they can be analyzed later on. After a few more stops along the way, the group headed outside for the grand finale. A man in a light blue vest powered on the big yellow water pressure tank. It's what AWI's watershed stewards use at more than 60 boat launches across the park. They flush out boat engines and power wash hulls to prevent the spread of invasive species. The stewardship program employs more than 100 people each summer. It's managed by Brett Wimsatt. Asty asked Wimsatt what happens if stewards do find invasives.
So when you find them, what do you do?
Yeah, so a couple things. One, so we have these 120 watercraft inspection stewards. So the first thing is inspection. And if we can just find it, a lot of times we've found these already on half a dozen different boats at two or three different launches this summer.
Wimsatt says it's key to catch invasive species like water chestnuts or Eurasian water milfoil before boaters launch into Adirondack waters.
Once it arrives, we're looking at $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 worth of management each year to keep up with dive teams or benthic barrier matting or potential chemical treatments, whatever it might be. So being able to stop it before it arrives, that's the best use of every single dollar.
AWI has a five-year, $13 million contract with the DEC to operate its boat inspection sites. At the end of the tour, Hasty said it was pretty eye-opening to tour the lab and to learn about AWI's efforts to stop the spread of invasives.
Sometimes you kind of take for granted. You just think, beautiful lake, people go in, people go out, boats going, boats go out. But then you realize there are things that we need to be aware of, ways we need to try to protect our waterways and our beautiful lakes and rivers.
Democrats control both the state assembly and Senate, so a collaboration between Hasty and Cashman really matters for this region. Cashman, who was elected just last year, is the North Country's only Democratic lawmaker in Albany. He says these kinds of visits by Hasty in the Adirondacks can make a big difference in budget talks back in Albany.
So when we're having conversations during session and we're advocating, he goes, yeah, I've been to that district. I've seen it. I've touched it. I've talked with your people.
The Adirondack Watershed Institute says it plans to spend $1 million in state funding on new lab equipment and facility upgrades. AWI says a more modernized lab will help its scientists and lab techs better keep track of the changing climate and environment in the Adirondacks. In Paul Smith's, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Homeless outreach teams operate in cities around New York State, but as the New York Public News Network's Jimmy Vielkind reports, the work is different in more rural areas like the Southern Tier.
Julie Overton is walking through tall grass by a highway outside Corning, about 75 miles west of Binghamton, near the Pennsylvania border. She's a social worker who's part of a state-funded program called SOS. Their mission is to help connect homeless people to housing and other services.
He lifted the tent. There's somebody in that white one, definitely. Does not want to be seen, so we'll leave supplies by it, and then we'll come back to this location and try to make a connection.
Annual survey results show homelessness rose around the state after the pandemic, prompting state officials to expand their outreach. SOS first launched in New York City, where it's easier to spot people needing shelter. But its recent expansion to smaller, rural places like the Southern Tier has required new tactics for reaching people in need.
It's harder because the people are hiding.
That's Butch Andreas. He led the team along railroad tracks and under overpasses, looking for fresh litter and warm coals from recent campfires. He spends hours driving around Elmira, Corning, and the rolling farmland that surrounds them.
It makes my job harder because I have to find these people. And then I have to, get them resources, which there aren't as many.
Butch spent decades roaming the country without permanent shelter, hopping trains, hitchhiking, and doing drugs. He's what SOS calls a peer, and he says his experiences help him connect with people.
It comes later when I start talking about things that they have experienced that I know about, and it is because it's the way I talk about it. I'm jaded, and it bothers me in that different way, and I'm like, it comes out in the slang that I say, too.
The SOS team does outreach like this at least once a month. They work without the police, and they take a soft approach to people they find.
It's a 9 to 12 a month initiative.
That's Corinne Zodum, or Dr. Z. She oversees the program for the State Office of Mental Health.
The model consists of, you know, outreach, you know, low-hanging fruit, connect people to quickly to services, helping them with housing, helping them remain in housing, and slowly backing off to ensure that they have the skills they need and the support they need to be able to function independently.
It can take a while to see that progress. We drive to a library in downtown Elmira. Julia's meeting with a 49-year-old man she's been helping named Mike Miller. They met at a soup kitchen shortly after he was released from prison.
She was a little mean. No, I'm just kidding.
No. Julie helped Mike apply for jobs and find housing, which was hard with a felony conviction.
Like, when I went to prison, I had everything. I had a place to live, you know what I mean? I had anything I wanted and stuff. So it was difficult to come home, go to a homeless shelter.
I kind of take the analogy of, like, this is your life. You're driving the bus.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're here to put gas in it. Sometimes we're here to change a tire. Sometimes we're just here to ride it with you, you know? So, and we do take that soft approach and build that rapport, which kept him coming back.
The next step for Mike will be finding and keeping a job. For Julie, it will be finding more people in need, more Mikes.
Good morning, SOS, we have supplies.
In Elmira, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Prices for basic essentials remain high, and many people are doing whatever they can to make ends meet, including donating plasma. Sam Dingman with the New York Public News Network explains.
It's a busy day at the BioLife Plasma Donation Center in Latham. Just inside the entryway, there's a bank of computers where prospective donors fill out applications. Every workstation is full. Once applicants are approved, they're taken to a treatment area and hooked up to a machine that takes a plasma sample. Then, as compensation for their time, they're given a BioLife debit card. The amount of money on the card depends on a few factors, but some people walk away from a donation session with a couple hundred dollars.
They said I didn't have a permanent home address, so they said I couldn't do it.
Kayla Sidden was hoping to donate today, but she was turned away.
What made you want to come in and donate?
I recently lost my job, so it's kind of hard to find a job again, so.
Did you know how much money you were possibly going to get?
No, I didn't.
Did you have your heart set on any particular amount, or?
A decent amount to help with rent.
So, struggling to pay the rent at the moment?
Yes. I'm staying at a hotel right now, and they don't use the hotel addresses. They need a permanent address, so.
Gotcha. And are you're having to stay at the hotel because of the job loss, or?
Yes. And plus, I can't afford an actual apartment right now, so.
Paul Beatty is in a similar situation.
I'd be happy with $100. You know, me and my wife and kid, we need some food and stuff like that, so.
Paul says he recently got approved for disability, but the payments haven't started yet. He's been out of work for a few years.
So, how have you been getting by in the last few years?
Oh, jeez, I'm borrowing money off of people, you know. My wife works here and there, you know, so. Just scraping. Basically.
Once the disability money starts flowing, Paul says he'll have about $3,800 a month. He thinks that should be enough to support his wife and kid, but it'll still be tight.
I remember when I owned a house, I had it foreclosed, but I remember back in, mid-2000s, you can go to Price Chopper and get a sirloin steak for like $2.99 a pound. Now it's like $6.99 a pound, so, you know, just everything. I mean, I remember going in the market and seeing the eggs for like $7 a dozen, and I'm like, I'd rather buy a chicken, you know?
think more and more as you see the economy change in the wrong direction and people are struggling and suffering to pay bills, people are looking for other ways to make money.
Dr. James McDonald is commissioner of the New York State Department of Health.
You know, some people can make up to $1,000 a month by donating plasma. They have to, you know, decide for themselves if that's something they want to do. But I think it really speaks to how hard it's becoming in our country to afford things.
New York has 26 licensed plasma donation centers, including that new BioLife Center in Latham, which opened last month. Plasma, among other things, contains a protein that helps fight liver disease. Donating usually takes about an hour and a half. McDonald says it's well-regulated and perfectly safe.
So a normal person can donate plasma twice a week, and people do.
Donating plasma and being compensated for it is not a new thing. McDonald says it's been happening for decades. But the circumstances that are driving people like Kayla and Paul to rely on it to cover the rent, those, according to Siena University economist Aaron Pasitti, are unique.
All of the economic changes the U.S. economy is going through are policy-induced, meaning they're the direct result of policies that the Trump administration has passed or is currently pursuing.
Pasitti says prices are going up because of President Donald Trump's tariffs, the war in Iran, and immigration policies that have gutted the agricultural labor force. Things people need to buy multiple times a week, like gas and groceries, have all gotten more expensive. And that means there's not much money left over for rent.
Inflation is something that hits lower and middle income households the hardest because a lot of consumption is basic necessities, food, fuel, shelter, clothing, and lower income households spend a greater percentage of their income on those necessities. Part of the irony of this is that a lot of those individuals are, you know, were supportive of President Trump in the 2024 election.
Paul Beatty is one of those individuals.
I love Trump. He's a good president, I think.
So you don't see this as connected with his policies?
I don't know, because I know you don't want to mess with him, you know. And I know Iran, if they had nuclear weapons or trying to get nuclear weapons, you know, and he don't put up with that stuff, you know. So
Paul also gets turned away from BioLife. He says he's going to try again tomorrow. But first, he has to figure out how to get home.
I need money just to get back to Schenectady on the bus, you know. I came up here on a bus.
Oh, so you came up here on a bus today just to do this?
Yes, yes. Yeah, just to get some extra cash, you know.
Reporting from Latham for the New York Public News Network, I'm Sam Dingman.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. As we celebrate the 250th birthday of the United States, I recently sat down with Dr. Bruce Dierstein to talk about the birth of New York. It's part of the book Revolutionary New York, 250 Years of Social Change, published by SUNY Press.
A lot of people, when they think about the revolution, naturally think about 1776, which we're going to celebrate this year. Declaration of Independence and the beginning of the war for independence and so on. But for New York, its birth year was 1777. And I sometimes call this New York's miracle year, because at the beginning of the year, if you've gone back there, New York State did not yet exist. New York Colony didn't exist anymore either, because the state had declared its independence through an ad hoc provincial council. But New York City was held by the British. Westchester County, Lower Hudson, really wasn't controlled by anybody. There were lots of loyalists, that is, people who wanted to maintain allegiance with Britain.
The Tories.
Tories, yes. That's the common name for them. And to the west, there were a number of Native American groups, some of them hostile, some of them friendly, some of them kind of undecided.
But New York was key. The idea was that who controlled New York would win the war. And the British were expected to invade from the west, the north, and the south, meeting in Albany, taking New York, splitting the New England colonies from the southern colonies.
Yeah, like a choke-off point. And yet, that didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. Because by the end of the year, if you had just lived through that year or you went back to the beginning at the end, by the end of the year, New York had written the Constitution, held elections, got the first state government going, and repelled invasions from the West and the South and the North, and elected its first government going with that and survived the destruction of its first state capital at Kingston.
Now, that's in a nutshell a summary, but I want to go back piece by piece through this because it's so interesting. And again, the book Revolutionary New York, 250 Years of Social Change, edited by Dr. Bruce Dierstein, published by SUNY Press out this year. Now, much like the Tea Party in Boston was rebuffing the taxes that Britain was putting on the colonists, the same thing existed in New York City, right? British were taxing trade restrictions and regulations, which roiled the colonists who felt their rights were violated as British subjects, which prompted them, I guess, if you'll clear this up, to elect what's called three provincial congresses.
That's correct. The story in New York is pretty ambiguous. It's hard to follow because in New York, as you said, there were a lot of Tories and Loyalists. And up until, maybe late 1775, New Yorkers hoped for some kind of reconciliation, a compromise, where the British would back off on some of their regulations and rules. But that didn't happen. And in fact, the British sent an invasion fleet, which conquered Long Island and New York City by the fall of 1776. And so what was left of New York was from a little bit north of that into the mid-Hudson Valley, up through Albany, and then through some indeterminate space to the west, the north, and the east. So it was very ambiguous. But with the Declaration of Independence, which New York endorsed, New York had cast its lot with independence.
That's Dr. Bruce Dierstein talking about the birth of New York.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.